From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, Bernie Sanders voters who delivered Michigan in 2016 have more choices this year, and all the campaigns are trying to square that primary math for needs with this fall.
Do you go with a more moderate candidate that can shore up the suburbs, or do you try to change the nature of the presidential electorate by piling more young people into it? One of those strategies has been tested, and it's not Senator Sanders' strategy.
Also, Michigan settles a case over juvenile offenders victimized by sexual assault.
Many of the youth that we represented had not even been convicted of anything. They were placed in the Department of Corrections for supervised probation.
And for your Friday listening, a lens on Detroit's jazz history and living legacy.
Detroit has a deep bench. I always tell people that. The reason why Detroit has a deep bench is because we have had generations that stayed here.
The voice of Marion Hayden and much more on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, Bernie Sanders pulled off a surprise upset back when he won Michigan's primary in 2016. This year, he's facing a more crowded field of candidates. So can he do it again? We'll talk about it later in the hour. But first, we want to warn you that this next conversation contains graphic descriptions of sexual violence. $80 million. That's what the state has agreed to pay, likely hundreds of people who say that they were raped when they were juveniles and incarcerated in adult prisons. It's one of the biggest settlements the state has ever paid out. Let's listen. We're going to play some of the voices of plaintiffs in the case describing their experiences.
Imagine a 16-year-old going inside a dark male facility where, you know, these men been in here for years upon years. This man in here been lifting weights or, you know, for I don't know how long.
I was sexually assaulted. He was in his 30s. He said that he was going to stab me if I told anyone.
Did he restrain you in some way?
Yes, by my neck. He grabbed me around my neck and with one arm and then he grabbed my private parts with the other hand.
It started from the gate. There was no pause throughout the whole time. There was no breath.
So they broke into my cell and quotation marks, obviously, because the correctional officers let them into my cell. You know, so that's how sick it is.
Staff did not know about when the gentleman came after me in the cell, but they knew everything leading up to that. They knew that I was getting harassed. They knew that I was receiving sexual threats and letters from other inmates, and they didn't care. You know, they actually kind of laughed at the idea of the thought of getting raped.
It's not just, you know, the prison culture, the prison mentality that goes on there. It doesn't just stay with prisoners. When we speak as correctional officers, somebody who we're supposed to look at as somebody who's supposed to be protecting us, or at least keeping things in order. I mean, I want everybody to be aware that I was sexually assaulted by a correctional officer.
With us now is the lead attorney for the plaintiffs, Deborah LaBelle. Deb, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
Could you recap for those who may just be coming to this how you first brought the suit and why?
We first brought the suit, and it was a team of lawyers who were contacted by youth from inside who had been experiencing sexual assault, sexual abuse, solitary confinement. And when we started to begin interviewing people, we found that it wasn't incidental, it wasn't occasional, but it was widespread sexual abuse by both adult prisoners on children as young as 13 and as well as staff.
Do you consider Michigan an outlier when it comes to housing juveniles in adult prisons?
Michigan is an outlier. There are very few states that continue to put youth under the age of 18 in adult prisons. And in fact, it's an outlier in the world because it's a human rights violation and no other country does it as well.
What was the state's argument in this case?
The state's argument was twofold. One, to deny the voices of the survivors that it was happening, and two, to say that the states, our Civil Rights Act and our Constitution should not apply to people who are in jails, in juvenile detention facilities, or prisons in this state.
There's so much in the evidence from this case that it feels very telling about how victims of sexual violence are treated, but most especially how inmates who are caught up in this are treated. Some inmates were asked in very graphic terms whether they enjoyed the abuse. We have a clip from a 2016 deposition that was taken by an assistant attorney general from one of your clients, from a video that you provided us. And it looks like it was taken from inside a prison. The assistant attorney general is asking one of your clients to describe an incident that happened to him. And again, just a warning to listeners, there's some language here that will be disturbing.
How did this end?
When he was done, he left.
Okay, he left the cell?
Yes.
Okay, was he naked when he left the cell?
No.
Okay, so I need you to describe in step-by-step detail what happened. So he's pumping on you for 7 minutes, he finishes, did he?
Can we take a break?
Sure.
I don't need a break.
You can't see this, of course, but in the video, the young man pulls the microphone off that's clipped to his shirt and throws it on the table. What's significant to you about this clip?
I think that some of the assistant attorney generals who worked in this case, and I would note that it's in a prior administration, that their behavior toward the youth was appalling. They treated them in a way that you would not treat a survivor of sexual abuse. They dismissed their claims. They were hostile and aggressive toward them. And all that did is increase the trauma and the pain inside. And it also allowed the abuse to continue. Because if you deny, when people step forward and tell you what's happening and you deny it, you basically give the green light to everybody who's in the prisons to continue to doing it, saying, in fact, we won't believe them anyways. So it doesn't matter if you allow it to continue. It allowed staff to continue to allow it and to facilitate it. And it really created a culture that was toxic.
Why did it take so long to get to this point where the state would be willing to settle?
You know, when I first started this case, I thought, of course, we're talking about children. And we're talking about many of the youth that we represented had not even been convicted of anything. They were placed in the Department of Corrections for supervised probation to give a second chance. So I thought when we filed it that surely this would be a case that would be relatively quickly resolved. And I think we were all stunned at the kind of ferocity in which that it was fought, the kind of constant appeals, the argument that they were not telling the truth, the aggressiveness, the challenge to their basic civil rights. And there were like 12 interlocutory appeals in which we won these appeals. Every challenge was rejected, you know, by the appellate courts, and yet the fight kept continuing. And we did not really get a break on a clear look at this until we got a new administration.
What changes has the state agreed to make as part of the settlement?
Well, they have agreed that they will work toward elimination of solitary confinement for youth, that they will do a range of training and protection of the youth from adult prisoners and also to enhance the training of staff, that youth can come forward and report what has happened to them, and then it must be listened to. It must be written down, whether it be verbal, and steps must be taken. There's also enhancement on the way investigations are handled. And so we've tried to create a system in which you can minimize this, the sexual abuse, the sexual assault, and the solitary, but you can't guarantee it unless you stop putting children in adult prisons.
Has the state agreed to stop this practice from ever happening again?
No. We did not receive an agreement to stop putting youth in adult prisons, which is the only thing that guarantees that this won't happen again.
Can we talk a little bit about your clients? There were 1,300-plus people who were part of the suit. What will the settlement money mean in their lives?
Well, just to be clear, there were 1,300 youth put in adult prisons between the time of 2010 and the conclusion of this litigation by settlement. no one is suggesting that every single one of those children were raped. But we know of hundreds that have been harmed and will participate in the, we expect to participate in the settlement. And it provides an ability for them to have resources, to both have safe places to live and to get treatment. We have been seeing for 6 years now kids stumble out of the prison where they were under the care and custody and supposed rehabilitation of the Michigan Department of Corrections, and they're returned to their families and communities with more damage than when they went in, with more challenges, with much difficult trajectories. So this funds, these funds, we are hopeful that with also a lot of people who have stepped forward in the universities and communities to say we will help them, we will provide them treatment, that we will be able to, they'll heal themselves and start to move forward.
Would you say this is the hardest case you've ever worked on?
Yes.
Was that in terms of emotion or in terms of the legal challenges involved?
We're talking about children. And so it was a difficult in terms of the legal challenges. We had to fight to declare a state amendment unconstitutional that precluded my clients from participating fully in their civil rights and equal protection under the law. That was a challenge, but it's hard to see children so harmed and not to be able to stop it.
Deborah LaBelle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Deb LaBelle is one of the attorneys, along with Dick Sobel and others, who this week obtained one of the largest settlements of a civil rights lawsuit in Michigan history. Coming up, a look into Michigan's rich jazz and blues history with celebrated bass player Marion Hayden.
I always tell my students that it's really hard to do in front of people what you have not done at all. So when I work on things in my personal practice, in my personal studio, I try to be very explorative in my work.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The music of Marion Hayden is just one chapter in a luxuriously long story of jazz in Detroit. A composer, bass player, 2016 Kresge Artist Fellow, we knew she was the perfect person to cap our Black History Month conversations about art, artists, and the African American experience. Marion Hayden's experience as a musician, composer, and educator at the University of Michigan links the generations. We asked her about a formative performance as she was growing up in Detroit that set her on the path.
I grew up in Detroit, and Detroit had such a great legacy of live music and great music in the schools, great public school music education. And one of the things that used to happen a lot when we were kids was they would take us down to see the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. And I just remember at that time they played in a building that's no longer here. It was called Ford Auditorium downtown. And I remember very well going into that space and hearing the instruments and just how impactful it was to feel the vibrations of the music at the time. And that was something that was really, really, really meaningful to me.
Could you say more about what that acoustic experience was like?
I think a lot of it was, as I said, you know, I really feel music in a real visceral way. So for me, it was the way that it just kind of envelops you when you're there. It's one thing to listen to music through through earphones and the kind of ways that we listen to recorded music, but it's another thing to be in a space where it really is, it's literally all over you. The sound is pouring over you physically. And, so that was something that was really, really impactful for me. And then it just continued on when I was really young, probably about maybe seven or eight, our church would have a function also at Ford Auditorium, oddly enough. And I remember one time they had a harpist by the name of Dorothy Ashby at this event. Now, Dorothy Ashby, of course, I didn't know at that time that I was seeing someone who was of great significance, but she was probably one of the first to really put harp on the map in jazz, and she was from Detroit also. And I remember seeing Dorothy live. I mean, she was just playing kind of a casual gig at our church, probably just a Sunday afternoon gig, because she was a legit musician. And to me, what legit musician means is she's someone who played music for her living and for her soul. So if you need to play music all the time, then you will play music in all different places, and not just where people are in uplifted spaces where you think that people are putting you on the pedestal of the stage. Your life is a stage. If you really play music for the right music, right, for the right reasons, your entire life is the stage. She was fantastic. I will never forget in my life what she played. She played Moon River. And it must have been not too long after, because that was from Breakfast at Tiffany's. And so it must not have been too long after that came out. And it was just, I will never forget it in my life. So, yeah, so I think, you know, for some of us, music, you know, will affect you that way.
What kind of rendition did she play?
She didn't. She just, if I remember correctly, she pretty much stated the melody, and she probably did some improvisations on the melody because she was playing solo that day. It was a solo harp performance, and it was exquisite.
Hearing Dorothy Ashby play Moon River with solos, just another church on Sunday for Marion Hayden.
Yeah, that was, so that was the level of immersion that music was at that time in Detroit.
A music education in Detroit is an opportunity like few others, but
yes.
You also had the opportunity to study with the late Marcus Belgrave.
Yes.
A person who did so much amazing session work across genres with top national acts, but also fell in love with the city and adopted Detroit. Will you tell me about him?
Yes. I met Marcus when I'll just do a short digression, which is, the programs that we present for youth to learn jazz and interact with professionals and players in the community are highly important. It's really important that we put our resources in that. And so there are several of us that met the jazz community through a community youth program called Metro Arts at the time, and that's how I met Marcus. And he and several other great musicians from the community were teaching there. And they were most willing to just share everything they knew about jazz with us and about music in general, because to play jazz is really to be not only a reading musician, but someone who also becomes very adept at music theory, too. So Marcus was energetic. He was a taskmaster. He was always willing to give me and those other young folks around him music that was a little bit harder than we could do. One of the wonderful things I appreciated him was that he asked us to work from not only as a standpoint of reading musicians, but also He insisted on that we train our ears so that we can understand what we were hearing and be able to react to what we were hearing in the music.
How would he do that?
Well, for instance, I remember one of the songs that I play that's in my ensemble book now is a song that was written by the great bass player, living bass player, Cecil McBee. And it was called Wilpon's Walk. So this was an early piece that Marcus taught us. And so Marcus never, this song was written out, but the bass line was never written out. And it was a very specific bass line. And he gave me that bass line. He sang that bass line to me. So I had to reproduce that bass line by ear from his singing. Right. So there were, you know, there were chord changes, as you know, we said there was some music that outlined other parts, but that specific part of the bass line I had to learn from his singing of it. And so it was very interesting because finally, several years later, I actually had a chance to hear the recording because somehow the recording had never surfaced when we were working on it. And it was in fact completely exactly how he had sung it to me. And I've always remembered that bass line the way he sang it to me. I learned it that way, and that was my lesson. So you know, you get a theoretical lesson from reading the music, and then you also get an ear lesson from having to understand what things sound like and being able to sing things back or play things back.
Listening to your recordings and also in your live performances, you have an ability to get large ensembles to really shine. Could you, I don't know if that speaks more to the, you know, your choice of collaborators and, you know, the intention that goes into that or the nature of the music itself. What would you say it takes to get a band to explode in that way?
I think it really first starts with personnel. A lot of times I don't always use the same personnel on any particular project because I may be looking for different things maybe trying to make a different statement about the music. So it starts with personnel. You know, you can write whatever you like, but the person is the interpreter. Interpretation of your music comes through an individual. So I try to really think deeply about what am I saying with this and who do I think will best say this particular thing, and there's some people that are pretty good at saying anything, and then there's some people that are just sublime at saying one particular thing or have a thing that they do that is just perfect for something. And so I try to think about it that way. And then when I compose, I try to think really deeply about, as I said, what is the story? There's always a story that I'm trying to convey in anything that I'm doing, whether I've written it myself, it's self-composed, or if I'm using someone else's material that I really enjoy. It's really what's the story? What's the narrative? What's the vision I'm trying to put in the mind of the audience? And So usually if I start that way, and then if I'm really careful about choosing folks that I know will make the vision happen, then it actually is, it's not that hard to get folks to come your way, you know.
Do you think that you would be able to get the effects that you do without the bench of collaborators who play around Detroit?
It would be harder. It would be harder. And Detroit has a deep bench. I always tell people that. Detroit has it has a deep bench. And the reason why Detroit has a deep bench is because we have had generations that stayed here. And I know in a lot of communities, people would get to a certain age and they just said, you know, I'm out of here. I'm moving to New York.
Going to New York,
or
yeah.
Or going to L.A. or whatever. Yeah, right. They're going to go to the coast. But the Detroit community has been such that we've had a deep bench of people that have stayed here. And as a result of that, they've been able to continue to encourage more generations to come up. And that is the reason why we continue to have great musicians that are resident here. And we can really put on projects that of many different sizes, of many different types, and really be able to represent the music just exquisitely, so extremely well.
I do still, as many ensembles as you're involved in, I do really enjoy your solo playing as well. When you play solo, are you alone with your thoughts?
I usually am, but I spend a lot of time in my personal practice practicing those things. I always tell my students that it's really hard to do in front of people what you have not done at all. So when I work on things in my personal practice, my personal studio, I try to be very explorative in my work, and I really try to dig down and explore all the different things that I've heard, try to be very very authentic, very real. Really pull from things, and I found that over the years, the pulling has been easier because there's just so much more to pull from, so many more life experiences. The well has gotten quite deep now.
In the last few decades, the jazz industry has developed a lot of glam in places like Los Angeles and London. And I feel like during that time, Detroit's developing a little different kind of identity. Like you say, a place where maybe people stayed to do what they were doing, whereas they might have sort of fallen in with one sound or another if they had gone to the coasts or somewhere else. How else would you describe what Detroit has to offer today, maybe in terms of sound?
I've always felt that Detroit, particularly since it's still 80-85% African American, represents the breadth of black music that you can absorb if you so choose to. And you can absorb not only jazz music, gospel, traditional gospel, contemporary gospel, rhythm and blues, hip-hop, and all of the different genres that are spurs of that, house music, all those things. So I find that if you spend some time here and really dig into the community. And our community is very welcoming for folks that would like to be a part and really, really dig in. That what you can come out with is your own music with some really interesting accents and influences. You can have your own music, and then and bring in some of those influences to bear that can really enrich what it is that you do. I think that, to be honest, the coastal cities actually look to Detroit for a lot more than we think they do. That a lot of times things actually start here and move out, as opposed to thinking that they start in the coast and move in.
Having recently returned, I can absolutely echo that. That is true. Marion Hayden. She can be seen in performance with the Momentum Project in concert with Alan Rowe, also of the U of M School of Music, March 14th in Ann Arbor. And her ensemble Straight Ahead is playing at Blue Llama March 27th. And here's something to look forward to a little bit later in the year. On June 6th, we can expect a performance of Ocean, The Life and Times of Phyllis Wheatley. That's Marion Hayden's composition, inspired by the poet and former slave who was the first black woman published in America. Marion Hayden, it is such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for stopping in.
Thank you for having me, April.
Still to come on the program, can Bernie Sanders pull off another win in Michigan's primary? That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Earlier in the show today, we heard from Deb LaBelle, one of the attorneys who obtained a large settlement in the civil rights lawsuit against the state of Michigan regarding juvenile inmates in cases of sexual assault. In response, Attorney General Dana Nessel issued a statement, along with the Department of Corrections, that reads, in part, "I believe prisoners are entitled to be treated with respect and basic human dignity. I know the MDOC has made significant strides under the leadership of Director Heidi Washington, and that the past 7 years of litigation do not reflect the values of her administration or the current reality of life inside Michigan's prison system." Super Tuesday's right around the corner, and March 10th, not far behind it. Voters who delivered a Michigan primary victory to Bernie Sanders in 2016 are once again being asked for their support. Many of the Democratic contenders poll pretty well in Michigan, but Bernie Sanders looks strong at this point in the contest. We've invited two polling professionals to talk about how much movement we can expect in the field over the next few weeks. Bernie Porn is a partner and president of the research and survey firm Epic MRA. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
And Adrian Hemond is a Democratic strategist and the CEO of Grassroots Midwest, a political consulting firm in Lansing. Adrian, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about who is mounting the biggest challenges against Bernie Sanders in the primary as of this moment. Adrian, how do you see that?
Well, right now, it seems like there are a couple of candidates that have a chance to secure the nomination who are not named Bernie Sanders. Former Vice President Joe Biden is still very much in the running. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has enough money that he can't be discounted. The remainder of the candidates, it's getting harder and harder to see a path to the nomination.
You know, somebody said to me yesterday of the University of Michigan basketball team, they're not the front runner, but I don't want to play him.
Yeah,
it seems like that's how people are feeling about Mike Bloomberg these days.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. Michael Bloomberg could spend as much money as both the Clinton and Trump campaigns spent in 2016, and he'd still be one of the 10 richest men in the world.
Bernie Porn, do you see other candidates as still being viable at this stage?
Well, that's going to depend on the South Carolina primary. If, in fact, Joe Biden wins by the 20-point margin he has in the most recent poll, I think that that could have an impact on the Super Tuesday primaries, especially those where there's a large African-American contingent of voters. But right now, in terms of Michigan, Bernie Sanders leads with 30% on the average of all the polls, followed by Biden at 18 with Bloomberg at 16, and then behind that is Warren at 12, Buttigieg at 10, and Amy Klobuchar at 5. And I don't see a path for Warren, Buttigieg, or Klobuchar. And I am assuming that after Super Tuesday, why they may have to decide to get out, although with the kind of money that can be raised online, it's not like it used to be, where if you don't raise money through the normal method of fundraising, when you run out of money, you have to get out. They have more money than candidates have had in the past.
Bernie Porn, what is Senator Sanders' ground game like? Is that something that's impacting his polls this time around?
Well, his ground game, I think, is excellent. Look at what he did in Nevada. He was not expected to perform as well as he did. And the Culinary Union staying out of the race, but they went directly to the casinos, and they were able to develop a level of support among Latino voters that I think surprised everyone.
Right, and we should, just to recap, they decided not to endorse, which was very unusual for them, because they differ with Senator Sanders on Medicare for All, having negotiated really strong health care plans for their members.
And if you look at especially the fundraising that he's been able to accomplish, I think that he's in a very strong position and is probably the odds-on favorite to go into the convention with the largest number of delegates. And I think according to 538, Nate Silver's group, they estimate that he's going to have at least 1,500 delegates and could potentially have 1,700 plus. If he has that many, I think it's going to be difficult to deny him the nomination.
Adrian Hemond, in 2016, when Bernie Sanders brought home what a lot of people thought was a surprise win in Michigan, many attributed it to the fact that he showed up and he touched base with important voters in a way that the Clinton campaign did not. Do you think winning in 2016 led to more focus in the Sanders campaign this time around? Maybe even, dare we say, more focus in Michigan?
You know, I think that there's probably an element of that. Michigan's a state that Senator Sanders needs to win. He won here in 2016. Any sort of strategy that Jeff Weaver and his campaign team are putting together is going to involve him winning Michigan to get to the number of delegates that he needs in order to be the nominee. So I do think that they're very focused on it. The disadvantage that they've got is he's not the only progressive choice in the race. In 2016, it was a sort of heads-up race with former Secretary Hillary Clinton, who was seen as the moderate option, and he was the sort of progressive option running from her left. But now you've also got Elizabeth Warren in this race that's trying to claim that mantle. And I think that muddies the water a little bit for Senator Sanders. I still expect him to win Michigan. I don't think that he's going to get anywhere close to the same number of votes that he did last time. With the new delegate rules, I don't know that it's going to be as important for him this time.
Let's say that Bernie Sanders wins the primary in Michigan, but maybe things go sideways for him on Super Tuesday and he doesn't get the nomination. Adrian, what happens to those voters? Do they stay home?
You know, I'm not sure. There are two different schools of thought here. One school of thought is that Senator Sanders expands the electorate by dragging young people into the general electorate who normally wouldn't be there. And if he's able to do that, then obviously he's in a strong position to win. That has not been done before. Young people in general don't vote very much, certainly not at the rates that middle-aged folks and seniors vote at. I do think that there are some folks who are less likely to vote if Senator Sanders is not the nominee because of the enthusiasm that he engenders there. The flip side of that is that Senator Sanders also turns off a lot of middle-of-the-road voters in suburban areas where Democrats have been performing quite well lately. Indeed, those suburban areas are what led to the Democrats flipping the U.S. Congress in 2018. And so, you know, you're sort of deciding between two different bets. Do you go with a more moderate candidate that can shore up the suburbs and continue Democratic expansion there? Or do you try to change the nature of the presidential electorate by piling more young people into it? One of those strategies has been tested a number of times in presidential politics, and it's not Senator Sanders' strategy.
Bernie Porn, do you remember what happened to Michigan's Sanders supporters in 2016 after Hillary Clinton got the party's nomination? I mean, that was kind of a critical factor, wasn't it?
I think that a lot of his supporters sat on their hands and did not participate. She also had a problem attracting African-American voters to the polls. 1 week out, we had a 4-point lead for Hillary over Trump. And given the way the trend line had been headed down for her in terms of the lead she had, she went from 11 down to 7, and then the Comey letter dropped it down to 4. We assumed it was going to be a very close election and thought that the the determining factor would be how many African Americans turned out. And sure enough, they brought everyone in, Bill Clinton, the president, the former president, and a number of others, but were unable to really turn out the black vote, and hence Hillary lost by 10,000 votes.
Right.
This time, it is a question as to whether or not Bernie can turn out younger voters. 56% of the voters are age 50 and over, the turnout in a general election. And it's doubtful that he's going to be able to turn out enough to be able to make up the difference that he could lose in terms of how Trump could attack him on some of his more what he will describe as socialistic tendencies on issues like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal. And one part of the Green New Deal, which I think could be problematic for him, if not in the primary, certainly in the general election, and that is one of the things of the Green New Deal is that everyone has to have an electric car by 2030. And all transportation needs to be electric.
That's interesting. I couldn't get Adrian off the fence about this, but you think that the younger voters would not necessarily give the Dems a better shot in the general?
Oh, I think that they will support the Democrats, but you also have the potential for Trump to be able to move independent voters against Bernie on the Medicare for All and on the Green New Deal. And, for example, this position on by 2030 all electric cars, there's no telling what Trump could do with that issue, suggesting that auto workers are going to be losing their job.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Bernie Porn of the polling and research firm Epic MRA and Adrian Hemond, partner and CEO of Grassroots Midwest. Let's talk a little bit more about African-American voters, especially in Metro Detroit. Adrian Hemond, do you see the Sanders campaign making an even more concerted play for their votes so far this season?
No, not any more than they did last time. That's not to say that they're not investing effort in it. They certainly are. But that part of the campaign looks real similar to 2016. African-American voters in general, we have not been Senator Sanders' base of support. You know, he's done really, really well with Latino voters, and he's done really, really well with younger voters. But he's had some difficulty cracking into the black community in a significant way. I don't see much difference in that in the primary right now, I think because they're pretty confident they can win Michigan without changing their strategy too much. And I think they're right about that. For the general election, it's going to need to be an area of focus. You know, Bernie talked about this a second ago that, you know, the president won Michigan by about 10,000 votes in 2016. Coincidentally, turnout in the city of Detroit was down by about 10,000 votes in 2016.
Yeah. I noticed that Senator Sanders started speaking out a bit more about the water shutoffs in the city. But again, one or two references does not the entire electorate engage. Do either of you know how Bernie Sanders is polling versus Joe Biden in Michigan right now?
Based on the average of all polls done by 538, again, it's Bernie getting about 30%, Biden getting 18%, Bloomberg 16, Warren 12, Buttigieg 10, Globicar 5. So that's a 12-point difference between Sanders and Biden. And I think if, in fact, Biden is able to capture a large share of African-American voters, that may tighten up the race a little bit. And if, in fact, before Michigan, one or two of the more moderate candidates were to exit out of the race, well, that would certainly have an impact on Joe Biden's prospects.
That's absolutely right. Joe Biden needs people out of this race.
Such as? Who do you think would be his first choice other than Bernie Sanders?
Other than Senator Sanders getting out of this race, I think that Mayor Pete Buttigieg would be really good for Joe Biden to get out of this race. Obviously, he's polling okay, not great, but he's obviously playing for those same moderate voters that Joe Biden is. So I think him getting out of the race would be very, very helpful for Biden. I think Klobuchar is playing for those same sort of voters. She's obviously not polling as well, so not as helpful to Biden if she gets out.
I keep wondering, the 140 character assessments of the race are that older African-American voters go for Biden, younger African-American voters go for Bernie. But I keep wondering if that's really doing justice to the breadth of the African-American electorate, especially in Michigan right now. Adrian, have you seen anything that might suggest that maybe there are some different currents at play here that we should keep in mind?
Absolutely. The Bloomberg campaign is investing really, really heavily in black support in Michigan. A number of the senior folks working on the Bloomberg campaign in Michigan are African American. They've invested a lot of money, not just in the city of Detroit, but in black communities throughout Michigan. They continue to ratchet up both the organizing and the advertising around the black community. A good example of that is up until 2 days ago, I was not hearing from the Bloomberg campaign on satellite radio. And now, you know, I listen to the NBA channel on satellite radio every morning on my way into work. And 2 days ago, I started hearing ads from the Bloomberg campaign that are very specifically targeted at African-American voters and his plan to increase black wealth. So I think that that's a sort of wild card here is, you know, how much black support is the Bloomberg campaign going to get, and how bad is that going to hurt Vice President Biden?
Gentlemen, is the Democratic primary in Michigan Bernie's to lose at this point?
I would say so. I would say so.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I think that, you know, short of a serious misstep by the Sanders campaign or something that's not being picked up in polling right now, I expect him to win Michigan. The question's by how much.
Well, I'll see you two at a watering hole of your choosing on election night, and we'll see how it plays out.
I love it.
Thank you both for your time. We've been talking with Adrian Hemond, a Democratic strategist and CEO of Grassroots Midwest. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
And also Bernie Porn, partner and president of Epic MRA. Bernie, very nice to have you as always.
Anytime. Thank you.
Next time on Stateside, Bernie Sanders courts Arab American voters.
Many young people are backing Bernie Sanders. That 18 to 35 demographic is overwhelmingly supportive of the senator. And Arab Americans are a young population in this country.
At the same time, candidates like Elizabeth Warren also are demanding to be taken seriously by voters in Dearborn and all throughout the region. Monday on Stateside, we're going to be talking with a journalist who visited mosques during the Iowa caucuses and is following the rest of the race, too. Join us. Did you see the socials after country music star Garth Brooks' performance at Ford Field last Saturday?
I guess I was wrong. I just don't belong. But then I've been there before.
Let me read one of these. If this is Garth, very sad. You just lost a fan. Trump 2020. Another fan wrote, I thought you were a true American that loves our country. And what, you ask, was Garth Brooks' offense? In deference to Michigan audiences at the Detroit Lions home field, Brooks wore a Barry Sanders number 20 jersey. Some fans thought that Garth was wearing Bernie Sanders gear, not the jersey of the beloved NFL Hall of Fame running back who spent his entire career with the Lions. Barry has taken it in stride and has since responded to the mistaken outrage, tweeting, of course, at Garth Brooks. Hey, Garth, want to be my VP, number 20 for 2020. Guy's got my vote. That's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. I'm April Baer. We'll see you Monday.